This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley. Neil Sedaka, the singer and songwriter whose recording and performing career stretched from the 1950s to the current decade, died last week. He was 86 years old. Neil Sedaka was born in Brighton Beach in 1939 and displayed his musical talent early on. His mother bought him his first piano at age 7, and at age 9, he got a child prodigy scholarship at Juilliard and was hand-selected by classical pianist Arthur Rubinstein to perform on live radio. But Sedaka was drawn elsewhere. Another young kid interested in pop music, Neil Diamond, lived across the street from him. His girlfriend in high school, Carol Klein, turned out to be a pretty good songwriter too, once she broke up with Sedaka and renamed herself Carol King. By then, young Neil had teamed with another budding songwriter, Howard Greenfield, who wrote lyrics to Neil's music. Their first break and first hit came in 1958, when Connie Francis was looking for a song to appeal to teenagers. Neil Sedaka was only 19 at the time, and she loved the song's innocence. Stupid Cupid became a top 20 hit for her. I can't do my homework and I can't be straight. I need them every morning for the half past eight. Stupid Cupid. I'm acting like a lovesick fool. You've even got me carrying those books to school. Stupid Cupid. Hey, hey, set me free. Stupid Cupid, stop picking on me. Connie Francis later had an even bigger hit with another of their songs, Where the Boys Are. Neil scored his own hit, a top 10 on Billboard, the next year with O Carol. And even though the lyrics were written by Greenfield, the message for Neil Sedaka was personal. He was singing about his ex-girlfriend, Carol King. Oh, Carol!
Treat me cruel. You hurt me and you make me cry. But if you leave me, I will surely die.
Sedaka scored another top 10 hit with Calendar Girl in 1960. Breaking Up Is Hard to Do in 1962 was his first number one hit. But after the British invasion arrived and music tastes changed, Neil Sedaka vanished from the charts for more than a decade. Then, in 1975, he enjoyed a major renaissance. Elton John signed him to his record label, and Sedaka had two number one hits that year. One was a soft ballad, Laughter in the Rain. And the other was Bad Blood, a duet with Elton himself. Bad blood, the woman was born to lie. Makes promises she can't keep with a wink of an eye. That same year, Neil Sedaka and Howard Greenfield, who had written their first hit songs together back in the 50s, collaborated again on a song that became a number one hit for the Captain and Tennille, Love Will Keep Us Together. If you listen closely to the end of that song, the Captain and Tennille snuck in a quick tribute, singing Sedaka's Back, followed by applause. The current century delivered no new hits, but Neil Sedaka remained active. In 2009, he released a children's album featuring playful revised lyrics to his most famous songs. The collection was called Waking Up Is Hard to Do and included the novelty numbers Where the Toys Are and Lunch Will Keep Us Together. His original songs and his own story were featured in a jukebox musical called Laughter in the Rain in 2010. Neil Sedaka performed until recently at a Studio City restaurant, popping up monthly for intimate Sunday performances. Today, we'll remember Neil Sedaka by listening to an interview Terry Gross conducted with him in 2007.
Now, when you were in your teens or just out of them, you had a knack for writing songs that would appeal to teenagers, maybe particularly to teenage girls, because the songs often had the message they wanted to hear, like they're growing up and becoming very desirable. Did you think about that consciously? Did you think of yourself as writing songs for teens?
Well, we were the teenagers of New York, coming from the Brill Building School of Songwriting. And yes, we were writing for the teenage market. The early lyrics or collaboration with Howard Greenfield, who was a marvelous lyricist and who could concise, it was almost the art of writing a 3-minute song. And we could tell a whole story in 3 minutes. Happy Birthday, Sweet 16, from the beginning to the end is a little novelette.
Did you always start with a lyrical hook as well as a musical one?
I always wrote the melody first, and I would prepare 2 or 3 melodies for Howie and play him that day, and whatever mood he might be in, he would choose one of those. And then it was a give and take. If the lyrics didn't fit, I would change a melody or a motif, and then he might change some things to accommodate me. It was a very close collaboration.
Now, were you in the Brill Building or the building near the Brill Building?
That's often 1619.
So that wasn't the Brill Building, it was the one next to it.
Yes, but we refer to it as the new Brill Building, the young writers, as opposed to the Irving Caesars in 1650, the old writers across the street.
So this is like the Rock and Roll Tin Pan Alley building as opposed to the Tin Pan Alley building.
Exactly.
So this is an office building where a lot of like young songwriters were working under contract, churning out songs. Who else was writing there when you were there?
I'm always asked, people are fascinated with the Brill Building. I brought Carole King, who I was dating in high school. Howie Greenfield and I were the first writers to be signed to Alden Music at the Brill Building. And then I brought Carole King and Jerry Goffin. The others were Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, Jeff Barry and Ellie Greenwich. Neil Diamond came for a time, Paul Simon. It was a very illustrious group, and it was excellent training. We came into an office, a cubicle. It was a tiny office from 10 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon, 5 days a week, and we wrote songs for a living. And it was, you know, one day you could come up with nothing, but the next day you were able to piece it together.
Were you all competitive with each other or friendly?
Well, you know, competition is good, and creativity, you bounce off other creative people. I think people are inspired by other musicians. So it was a good atmosphere. And at the end of the day, all of us would go into Al Nevin's office and play the songs, and they would say which artists are coming up for sessions, whether it be the Righteous Brothers or the Chiffons or so many groups, and the best song won out.
Most of the songwriters there were writing for other singers. And you wrote songs that other singers recorded, but you wrote a lot of songs that you recorded yourself. Were you originally hired to write for other people?
I came in as a writer the first 6 months, and my two of my songs were recorded. Connie Francis did Stupid Cupid, and before that, Atlantic Records, Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler took my songs and recorded them with Clyde McFatter and Laverne Baker. But about 6 months to a year into the contract, I was 19, and I had a great desire to record my own songs. And I was brought into RCA Victor. Steve Scholes, who was the top A&R man, he had just brought Elvis Presley from Sun Records to RCA. And I auditioned for him with a song called The Diary, and he signed me to a 5-year contract. And, Terry, I was very fortunate between 1958 and 1963, to the shock of my family after studying at the Juilliard, I sold 40 million records in the 5 years. So
yeah.
I did.
Sure, your parents were happy about that in spite of their classical aspirations for you.
My mother, in fact, was not happy at the beginning. But, you know, I bought her Ming stole, so she was very, very happy after that.
How did it become a trademark? And how did you figure out what syllables to use, whether it should be Wella Wella or Doobie Doobie?
Well, it started early in the career, and it was kind of someone singing along. Perhaps they were just getting into the song, and they didn't get into the lyric yet. So they were going, down, doobie, doo, down, down, before they began the actual song. And it was, how did I choose the syllables? The most important thing in songwriting was the marriage of words and music. And the syllables had to fit the particular melody. And I was very keen on that marriage of lyrics or syllables set to music.
What was the first song you did that on?
I think it was O'Carroll. I did double voice. But Breaking Up is an interesting song because I think I'm the only artist who has recorded his song twice. I did it first as a rock and roll song in 1962, and then I re-recorded Breaking Up Is Hard to Do 15 years later as a slow gin mill song. And by the way, both of them were huge successes.
What made you decide to do a slower and more adult version of the song in 1975?
Lenny Welch, a great singer who had a hit called Since I Fell for You, mm-hmm. was a friend and asked if I had any follow-up to Since I Fell for You. And I was fooling around at the piano one day and discovered that Breaking Up Is Hard to Do worked as a slow song. And I presented it to him. He loved it and recorded it as a ballad. And it was an R&B hit. And then I would do it as an encore in my concerts. And the audience reaction was so good that I decided to re-record it as a ballad.
And you made some changes on it. It's not just that the tempo's slower. The chords are really different.
Well, of course, it's a more sophisticated. And when you have a ballad hit, it's a career move. It's a much better career vehicle. And when you're doing it as a jazz piece, you automatically change some of the chords to make them sound like a standard, like you're listening to a Dinah Washington record.
Okay, so let's hear Neil Sedaka's two versions of his song Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, the first from 1962, the second from 1975. Both versions are featured on his new CD, The Definitive Collection of Neil Sedaka.
Do-do-do-down, do-be-do-down, down, comma, comma, down.
Now, of course, you know, on American Idol a few years ago, Ruben did a slow version of Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. And mm-hmm. Clay, of course, recorded Solitaire. And you were a judge, a guest judge.
Mm.
What kind of advice did they ask you? Or did they give you before being a judge? Did they tell you to be nice or to take the gloves off and be tough?
Well, you know, I wanted to be tough. But my son said, Dad, you know, there are 30 million people watching. Be careful of what you say. And, you know, I think that it's a very difficult, these kids are on in front of millions and millions of people. It's a very difficult thing. But I must tell you how I got on. everyone was saying, oh, Neil, you must be a celebrity judge. I said, oh, there are so many people trying to get on. And my publishers called and said, perhaps if you called personally to the show, you have a better chance. And I picked up the telephone, spoke to a Susan Slamer on the staff. I said, hi, this is Neil Sedaka. I watch the show. I'd love to be on as a celebrity judge. And she said, are you kidding? Who is this? I said, no, it's Neil Sedaka. She said, sit there. We're having a meeting. She called me back in an hour and said, you'll be on in 2 weeks, and the five finalists will be singing all Neil Sedaka songs. I was over the moon.
What impact did it have on your career?
The catalog went through the roof. All of the old records started to sell. Amazon.com was ringing off the walls. And Solitaire by Clay was one of the biggest, I think the second biggest seller of that year.
We were talking about how you grew up playing classical music and how your mother early on would have preferred that you play classical music. In those early days, were you torn in two directions, pop versus classical?
No, I was a very serious piano student. I started playing at age 8. At 9, I entered the prep school of the Juilliard when it was on 125th Street and Claremont Avenue. I studied with the great Edgar Roberts. And when I was 13, I discovered that I could write songs. I wasn't very popular in school. I wasn't a jock and wasn't one of the popular kids playing Chopin and Bach. So I was fascinated by the reaction I got. I was invited to all of the teenage parties, and that was a very big deal in those days, if you can play your own songs or hits of the day. So it was a twofold study of songwriting and going to Juilliard every Saturday, and then I went to the college, Juilliard College, studied with Adele Marcus. And when I was 19, I had to make a decision which direction to go. And, the money is, being from a very poor family, my father was a taxi driver in Brooklyn for 30 years and worked very hard. And I think every teenager wanted to be a rock and roll star, that, you know, that would be very exciting to any kid of that age. So I did pursue it, but I never dropped the classical music because I still basically love it, and those are my roots.
In an autobiography that you wrote a few years ago, you write about a song, Mr. Moon, that you wrote when you were in high school and that you performed in high school, but the principal didn't like the song. You describe it as having been a little risque for school. I was dying to hear how it went.
Well, I was a freshman at Lincoln High School, and as I said, not one of the popular kids. And I had started writing rock and roll. It was the beginning of rock and roll. And I wrote a song called Mr. Moon and sang it at one of the Ballyhoo shows in the auditorium. And there was to be two performances. The first performance, the kids started to jump and dance and bump and grind. And it was a sensation, except when Abraham Lass, the principal, called me into his office and said, you know, Neil, we can't have that kind of behavior. We'd like you to do something else, another kind of song for the second performance. And there was a petition signed by the students that they wanted Neil to do Mr. Moon again. And we won, and I did it again. It was not a dirty song in any way, but it was kind of a bump and grind, chick, 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 you know, that old rock and roll tempo, which was very new at the time.
Could you do a few bars of it?
Oh, my goodness, I was 16. Mr. Moon, guide your love back to me. Ha, 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 ha. Sounds very, very fragile now. Very timid.
Yeah, you know, you write in that memoir, you write, by first grade I was known as the school sissy. I practiced walking and gesturing in a masculine fashion in front of the mirror. So it made me think you were probably picked on a lot.
Yes, that was one of the reasons that I wanted to be recognized. I wanted to please people. I think in many instances, artists who begin as, are neglected and are made fun of, I think that they pursue these careers to be noticed, to be accepted, and to be revered. So I showed those football players.
Yeah. Well, did it make you self-conscious when you started performing about whether you should look more macho as a performer?
I studied in front of a mirror. I had a sister, Ronnie, who I adored, and she was my hero. She was 18 months older, beautiful, popular, and, I had to stand in front of a mirror, I'll be totally honest with you, and learn how to move in a more macho way, how to carry my books, how to... It was a metamorphosis.
You know, I think in that era, every teenager was standing in front of a mirror, and some people were learning to dance in front of a mirror. Some people were pretending they were singing into a microphone in front of a mirror, and other people were just trying to figure out how to fix their hair or look better. But don't you think, like, every boy and girl is standing in front of a mirror then?
Yes, but I must correct you. I didn't use the word sissy. I used the word effeminine, because I was raised by six women. We were, believe it or not, 11 people in a two-bedroom apartment in Brighton Beach. My mother, my sister, my five aunts, and my grandmother. So these are the people who I emulated. So it was a marvelous upbringing because I was spoiled by all these women.
Now, a few years ago, you recorded an album of Yiddish songs called Brighton Beach Memories. You grew up in Brighton Beach.
Yes.
Were these songs that you grew up hearing?
Yes. My mother played the Barry Sisters records. These were the great old standards. Viachin Zalichkein, Shein Vidi Levuna, my Yiddish mama. I heard them at bar mitzvahs and weddings and family picnics. And I decided at this stage of my career that I wanted to do things for my own heart, for my own spirit, not particularly looking for commerciality. And I got some wonderful reaction. I did an all-Yiddish concert at Carnegie Hall a couple of years ago for the Volksbühne Jewish Theater in New York. And it wound up to be a very exciting, very exciting album. I performed with a few klezmer groups in California and Chicago, the Klezmatics. And it was my roots, and I'm very proud of where I came from. I think, you know, you have to remember where you came from, and this was very special.
I want to play a track from the album. Let me ask you to choose one of your favorites.
I'd love to hear Yiddish Mama. I do it half in English and half in Yiddish. And it reminds me of my mother, who passed away last year, Eleanor Sadaka, who lived to 89. She lived a great life. But I think it was originally done by Sophie Tucker years ago, and it's a very moving, very emotional song.
Well, let's hear Neil Sedaka's recording of My Yiddish Mama from his album Brighton Beach Memories.
A Yiddish Mama Es gibt nicht besser in der Welt A Yiddish Mama Oy weh wie bitter, wenn sie fällt Wie schön und lichtig ist in Heus, wenn die Mamas du. Wie treurig finns der Welt, wenn Gott nimmt dir auf eulem Habu. In Wasser und Feuer wollt sie gelaufen vor ihr Kind.
This is Neil Sedaka from his album Brighton Beach Memories that came out a few years ago. Now, earlier we heard two different versions of your song Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, one from the early 60s, one from the mid-70s. When did your string of hits in the 60s end? People always say that for the American pop songwriters and singers, their careers were really interrupted or ended by the British invasion. Is that too simplistic, or do you think that's an accurate description?
That's an accurate description, Terry. There was also a natural progression of 5 years of hits. The Everly Brothers, Connie Francis, Fats Domino, Brenda Lee. We all didn't have more than 5 years. But as you said, the British invasion, the great Beatles and Rolling Stones came. I wanted to write that style, and I did write that style, but my public wouldn't accept it, and the record company wouldn't accept it. So for 11 years, I took a back seat, took stock of myself, raised a family, had my two children, and wrote for a publishing firm, and had some great artists record my songs, Andy Williams, Johnny Mathis, Peggy Lee, Shirley Bassey. But you know, once you get a taste of being in front of the public, you never get over that. And it was 11 years later, around 1974-75, actually, that I lived in England. I moved my wife and children to England because in England they respected the original rock and rollers in America. And it was there that I met Elton John, who was starting a record company, Rocket Records, in America. And he was a big fan of my early records. And he knew that I was recording with a group called the 10cc's in Stockport, England. Marvelous group at the time. And I made two albums with them, and both of them were successes in the UK. And Elton said, you know, I think I could launch you again in America. And I said, well, that would be remarkable. Elton had me record an album called Sedaka's Back, which was a remarkable comeback for me. And I always thank Elton for that.
Was Laughter in the Rain on that?
Yes.
Yeah, and that was a really big hit for you.
Well, after 11 years, to have a number one record was a remarkable comeback. And Love Will Keep Us Together was on, and The Immigrant, and That's When the Music Takes Me. I was very proud of the collection.
So how much are you still writing songs now?
I write once or twice a year. I wrote some new songs that I'm working on for a children's album. I actually rewrote, since I have three new grandchildren, my son and his wife got after me and said, you know, you're Papa Neil now, you have to write some children's songs. So I came up with the idea of changing the lyrics to some of my original hits. So I did Waking Up Is Hard to Do. I did Where the Toys Are. Don't trip over your toys, put them away neatly. And so perhaps I'll be Papa Neil on television. Who knows?
I'm trying to think of a really torchy version of Where the Toys Are. Well, it's really been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Same here, Terry. And it's a wonderful program. Congratulations. Continued success.
Neil Sedaka speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. The co-composer of Where the Boys Are, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, and Love Will Keep Us Together died last week at age 86.
Lunch, lunch will keep us together. There's no meal that's better. Just give me a fork and a spoon. It's almost noon. Make me some food, cause I wanna eat soon. Just stop, cause I'm really hungry. Stop. Can hear keep us together. Hot dogs, mac and cheese, French fries and ketchup, I'll drown. When the others say they're stuffed, who's still chowing?
This is Fresh Air.